This is a Media Lab podcast. Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. We are now at the song A Bowler Hat, which in many ways is this encapsulation of what the entire point of Pacific Overtures even is. So I'm really excited to be able to talk to Sam Seamock here today, who we mentioned in this episode is part of the touring company of My Fair Lady. Because this was recorded a few weeks ago, Sam wasn't quite sure if that was happening or when it was going to happen. I have it on good authority as of just moments ago, as I was on my phone browsing Instagram, that apparently September 14th is when they start performing live once again. So that's a good way to see my guest here today on the stage doing his thing, and I would definitely recommend going and doing that. We don't need to beat around the bush. Let's get into the episode and start talking about A Bowler Hat.
It's called A Bowler Hat. I have no wife. The swallow flies.
Sam Seamock, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Kyle.
I'm excited to talk with you, being a performer of musical theater. In fact, I know it's weird times right now, but you were touring with the My Fair Lady cast around the United States.
We're actually, we're going back out by the end of the year, hopefully, you know, as long as...
Fingers crossed,
you know, we'll see when that happens, but we're in talks to continue the tour before the end of the year, so we're excited.
That must be exciting. I mean, this is such an understatement to say, but it's been such a weird 18 months for so many people.
Right.
But for a performer, I mean, you must be itching to get back to performing, like what you like to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've transitioned a little bit into, you know, I'm starting to build a parallel career in technical writing. So, you know, it's not, you know, it's an interesting field, but it's definitely not what I set out to do originally. But it's, you know, one of the benefits is that there aren't too many silver linings to this last year. But, you know, one of them is I got to spend a lot of time with family. And, you know, I'd sort of been neglecting those relationships in pursuit of my career. But the other one is just remembering that there are other things that can be done to make money, to save money and to you know, keep yourself going. And they don't all have to be, it doesn't have to be being on stage or waiting tables. You know, you can, a lot of actors have figured out how to work remotely. And that's, I think it's a very powerful thing for an actor to be able to do.
Was there a show or a moment that you recall where it kind of flipped that switch? Where it was like, I want to do that.
I don't know if there was a moment when it happened. I do remember in middle school, I think it was seventh or eighth grade, I had a teacher, Mrs. Perla Mullins, who was sort of, she was like an extracurricular teacher, one of the, we called them enrichment classes. It wasn't one of the core English, social studies, et cetera. And we only had her like for, you know, maybe a month out of the year or something. And one of the assignments that she had, it was all sort of early career planning. She was like, well, think about a career that you want to pursue and then do some research into it. And I was like, oh, it might be fun to be an actor. I'd done a bunch of community theater at that point. And I started looking into it and did some very realistic research into what an actor's life is. And, you know, a lot of kids, they're like, oh, I want to be on Broadway. I want to be in movies in Hollywood. I'm going to go, you know, follow my dreams. And it's in seventh or eighth grade, I wrote this essay on like, oh, you know, I'm a supporting character on a semi-successful soap opera. And, you know, I'm driving home. It's like my 45-minute commute in LA, something like that. It wasn't like, oh, I'm this big star. You know, I never had those aspirations. I mean, everybody kind of has those aspirations. It's you know, it's all part of the dream, et cetera. No, I was always of the mindset of like, people make a career of this and they don't have to be Brad Pitt in order to make a living. And you can support yourself by being an actor. And that's, you know, I talk to students a lot and I tell them that very thing. You don't have to be in pursuit of being some big star. There are people that work in regional scenes in Boston and Minneapolis. They make good careers and good, successful lives out of it. And yeah, that's what I kind of set out to do. And I've been very fortunate to have gotten where I've gotten so far. And you know, knock on wood, things keep moving forward. And yeah, it's all just literally living the dream, with the exception of the last 18 months.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, I'm excited to see where that goes. Do you remember the first time you were introduced to Sondheim in general?
Well, so it was one of two. I don't know. I think I was doing a show the summer after my junior year in high school. This is my first professional show. I was doing a production of Grease up at Seacoast Repertory Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. In Portsmouth, there was a record store, and one of the sections was like musical theater. And because it was like the early 2000s, and musical theater was sort of at its low point of popularity in the century. This is before Glee, before Smash, really, before High School Musical like elevated it to popularity again. So the musical theater section was all you could buy CDs for, you know, $3-5. Nobody cared.
Yeah, yeah.
I just bought a bunch of them. I think one of my friends had introduced me to Into the Woods, and I had kind of watched it a little bit. I like bought the album, and I bought Assassins. I think Assassins was where I really got deep into Sondheim, because I'm a history nerd too, and.
Gotcha.
And so the way that just listening to Assassins, and I loved Into the Woods too, you know, watching the original, the PBS broadcast on DVD, that was super cool. Giants in the Sky, you know, I sang that for my college audition. But I think it was really Assassins that introduced me to the way that Sondheim can take these different musical styles. And, you know, he has this Copland esque, like this Americana feel, and depending on the character, depending on the time period, you know, he has Giuseppe Zangara singing a tarantella, and it's mashed up with the
pastiche of those songs.
And you know, you have that with the "That's Just How I Say Drums" about this is very bombastic, you know, Americana feel, and that was, you know, that was, I think, ultimately my introduction to what Sondheim really was. Whereas Into the Woods is a beautiful show, I love it so much. And I was like, oh, that's cool. It's like, you know, fairy tales. And here's, here's what happens after they get their happily ever after and everything. But yeah, I think it was definitely Assassins that hooked me.
I think that's just an interesting double feature, I guess, for lack of a better word, because this is very reductive. But I always find it so fascinating, those kind of essentially came right after each other. So you have like Into the Woods, which is all about finding hope. And then Assassins is about losing hope. I just think it's such an interesting like duology that he was able to do. And it kind of shows his brilliance a little bit.
Right.
In that it's like, when someone comes to you and says like, we want to make a musical about all the assassinations that have happened in the United States. It's like, well, okay, we'll make something out of that.
Yeah.
And then it works.
I think one of the most important lines or lyrics in the show is nobody would listen. And I think Assassins is all about what happens when society stops listening to individuals. And they're just, you know, they're talking into their tape recorders alone, or they're trying to convince their friends that they have some sort of power, or they're trying to, you know, insanely get the attention of Jodie Foster. But in the end, it's all people who don't feel listened to, and that's what happens. And I think that's it's an important message.
So when it comes to this show, Pacific Overtures, I mean, the recurring thing that I keep circling around here this season is that this seems to be the show that oftentimes people come to last or nearly last, because it is, while there's some great music and stuff that comes out of it that continually gets performed, it doesn't get revived very often. And I think it has this aura, and maybe this is just me projecting, but I think it has this aura of being like, that's not one of the great ones that Sondheim wrote, even though there's like this cult following of it that I keep running into. So whether that's true or not, I'm interested to know like when you first were introduced to Pacific Overtures.
I think it was probably college, and I didn't get super into it because of the things you said. You know, I feel that it is, in a sense, purposefully inaccessible. Some extent. And it's still accessible, you know, but it's I think part of its writing is to make an American audience feel like foreigners on their own soil. And so you're watching it and you're feeling it's a little disjointed, and it's not, it draws on Kabuki and no theater in ways that Western audiences aren't familiar with. Like we don't know Kabuki theater. We don't know no theater. Even me, like, you know, I'm an Asian American actor, but I'm not a Japanese theater historian. I don't know the specifics, but I do know like the song we're going to talk about, Bowler Hat, is heavily, it draws on these kabuki storytelling methods of the reciter speaking the letters that Kayama's writing, and then juxtaposition of Manjiro and Kayama on opposite sides of the stage. And yeah, when it comes to the show in general, I think, you know, I got into it in college, and the song that I really liked most at that point was Chrysanthemum Tea, which in the original is, I think that's Alvin Ng who sings it brilliantly. And yeah, it's just that rhyme scheme, that Sondheim rhymes are just so good. But Chrysanthemum Tea, it's an herb that's superb for disturbances at sea. Is the Shogun feeling better? Right, good. Right. Now, what about this letter? You know, it's so fun and a little dark. And then it also has those moments of the soothsayers coming in, the priests coming in. And it actually, it's good to talk about Chrysanthemum Tea, I think, because in Bowler Hat, there are a lot of references.
There's a references back to it.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, you look at the two and Chrysanthemum Tea is so much about the tradition and the superstition of, you know, the pre-Westernized Japanese culture, you know, sort of the spider on the wall. And what does that mean? It signifies success, and whether or not the soothsayer is just, you know, spitting out all this BS, you know, which is the case in the way that it's staged. It all has meaning to the ancient Japanese. And then Bowler Hat indicates how that changes over the course of time.
It does. And the more that I've delved into this song this week, I have now listened to multiple recordings multiple times throughout the last few days just to get knowledgeable and like into this song specifically. I think this is such a brilliant 5 minutes of musical theater, especially if you watch that stage and you can watch the 1976 film version that's on YouTube, just the way that it plays around with like set design and like the theatricality of turning around and now I have a monocle on and like the reciter talking about what's going on with the letters. Like, it's just this beautiful little encapsulation of like, we're taking 15 years of history, mashing it into 5 years, and there's this emotional arc that runs through the entire thing.
Right.
So yeah, for me, this is like a brilliant little piece of just theater by itself.
Yes, for sure. And then, you know, the another kabuki, I don't know if this kabuki or no, but the kabuki, the Japanese theater style of the stagehands are coming on and dressed in all black, and they do all the set changes right in front of you. Very, very cool. Ultimately, what I like about Bowler Hat most, I think, is that it sort of encapsulates the whole show. I think the thesis of Pacific Overtures is contained within Bowler Hat.
It's like almost like, yeah, the entire show's theme is it's this song,
right,
essentially.
Right.
This might be dumb, but I wanted to set the stage for just one element of this song, which is the bowler hat specifically. And I feel like most people are going to know when I say bowler hat, like what that looks like. You can envision it. But just in case there's anyone out there that's like, I don't really know what a bowler hat is. Invented in 1849. It's this like rounded top hat, not a flat top like a normal top hat is, but still with the brim around it. So some popular culture you might be familiar with. Charlie Chaplin wore a bowler hat. The father in Mary Poppins wears a bowler hat. Main character in A Clockwork Orange wears a bowler hat. And if you're a Tintin fan, Thompson and Thompson wear them as well. Or if you're French, it's DuPont and DuPont. But either way, all of those people wear bowler hats. So you're envisioning that kind of look within this song. What we're going to do, this is a little bit different, and Sondheim writes about this in the book, where there is, of course, these spoken bits by the reciter. And I think it's such a loss that the original Broadway cast recording does not include them, because I think it's essential to understand how this song is working. Kayama is writing a letter to Lord Abe and then singing these in between those like written points. So I don't think you get the full emotional context of the song without those spoken bits happening.
Right. And his transformation is ultimately, I think you do need those. And it's nice that the new Broadway cast with, you know, the one with B.D. Wong as a reciter, that they include those. And it does add so much. And you really see Kayama's, his journey.
It's kind of playing around with like, this is what I'm writing to you, but this is actually what I'm thinking. And I like that there's that play that's going on here.
For
too.
Sure.
I am breaking into the conversation here right now to tell you about some of the people and sponsors that help make this show continue to go. You know, if you would like to help support this show for absolutely free, you can give a rating and review on whatever app you listen to podcasts in. It's greatly appreciated. And if you'd like to help monetarily, which will only help to grow and make this show better, you can do so over at our Patreon page. Please do not donate if it impacts you negatively financially. That does remind me, though, to give a huge thank you to Ron, who is our brand new patron for this week. Thank you so much for joining the support over there. And of course, a big thank you to the God That's Good tier from Patreon, the triumphant quartet of Jack, Todd, Carrie, and Witty. Putting It Together is also a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. Cold drafts, flickering lights, and where's that leak coming from? If you've ever wondered what's really going on in your home, Roomie's Ask a Home Inspector service can help. Connect with a certified professional home inspector by phone or video call and get your questions answered. Roomie will let you know what's easily fixable with a little DIY, or when you might need to call in some professional help. Visit roomie.ca, that's R-U-M-I.ca, and book your Ask a Home Inspector appointment today. This episode of Putting It Together is also brought to you by the Calgary Foundation, proudly supporting community needs for 65 years. Whether someone is battling depression, fleeing domestic abuse, or worried about putting food on the table, it's times like these that inspire people to help others during a period of unprecedented needs. The Calgary Foundation is here to help. Through the generous support of donors, the Foundation offers a wide range of funding opportunities for organizations who share a common goal of building a healthy, giving, caring, and resilient community, one where everyone thrives. If you're part of a registered charity looking for a grant, discover a wealth of resources at calgaryfoundation.org and learn more about the Calgary Foundation on their Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube channel. To start things off here then, this is what the reciter begins with before we get into the song. A letter from Kiyama Yasayaman to the Shogun. My Lord Abe, it is my privilege to inform you of the current state of our relationship with foreigners here in Uraga. As you have doubtless learned from servants far more worthy than myself, there are now 200 Westerners among us, five times as many as a year ago when they first came. And then Kiyama sings, it's called a bowler hat. I have no wife. The swallow flying through the sky is not as swift as I am flying through my life. You pour the milk before the tea. The Dutch ambassador is no fool. I must remember that.
It's called a bowler hat. I have no wife. The swallow flying through the sky is not as swift as I am flying through my life. You pour the milk before the tea. Dutch ambassador is no fool. I must remember that.
Well, I mean, you know, like you said, the letter to Lord Abe, it demonstrates, you know, this is what he's saying. And as he writes more letters, you see how he shifts a little bit in his power, how he gains power as time goes on. And you can see him, the way he talks about the Dutch ambassador, the way he learns about, you know, foreign diplomacy, and right. The tricks of like, oh yeah, you're pour the milk before the tea, so that, you know, when you talk with these people, you're doing appealing to their sense of custom and tradition. And meanwhile, he's writing to Lord Abe about, oh, I'm sure there are servants much more worthy than I. Right. And it's so obsequious and fawning because that's how he maintains power.
I know I'm going to offend all of my UK listeners, but putting milk in before the tea is bonkers to me. I always put it in after. Right. But that's just a me thing.
You're gonna need the hot tea to melt the sugar, you know. But if you're gonna bastardize your tea with sugar, that's, you know, that's me.
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But what's interesting too is, you know, they're juxtaposed on the stage. Like while Kayama is writing the letter and he's singing his verses, Manjiro is over on the other side of the stage performing a traditional tea ceremony. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, you know, like he talks about the tea and then there's a traditional Japanese tea ceremony happening on the other side of the stage with no milk. And so as this is happening, the tea ceremony is so slow and subtle and gradual and purposeful. And the lyric, the swallow flying through the sky is not as swift as I am flying through my life. It's sort of this recognition of Kayama. I think he's busy now. He has all these things that he's occupying his time with, whereas the old Kayama when he's a, when he was a samurai, there's more simplicity, there's more purpose to each action in the very traditional cultural Japanese sense of simplicity and minimalism. And now that he has all these appointments, and he has a fitting for his new jacket, and he has to go buy a new hat, and he has to go do these things, and that makes you speed through your life so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is such an interesting thing to bring up, because once again, going back to the fact that this whole entire song encompasses 15 years of his life, it's supposed to represent 15 years. He's mentioning it right here. It's like, it is going fast. Like, my life is going super fast right now. And we kind of see that on stage, how fast it's going. Calls back to the fact that, like, things in society can feel like they change, even though it's, you know, taking years upon years to get to this point. But as an individual, it can feel like it's going by very, very quickly. The other thing that I think is really interesting, the way that this is set up, is that there is three things that are mentioned. The swallow, or bird. There's a mention of his wife, or no wife in this case, and then the Dutch ambassador. And those things come back two more times within this song. And I think each time tells us more about his life and what's going on. So I'd like that's set up here, like right from the very beginning, where it's like, the swallow, that's instructive of my life. I don't have a wife right now, which is sad because we have already seen his wife kill herself too in the first act. And then the mention of this Dutch ambassador is like, I have to remember that he is no fool, because I think that becomes super important here later on too. So yeah, there's all these elements I think that are really interesting and bright up here at the very beginning. Kiyama continues on. He doesn't. The reciter continues on and says, 3 years ago, we set aside one district of the town for Westerners, and yet we are still unable to provide them with residences which they consider suitable. For this, I humbly ask your indulgence. And Kiyama sings, I wear a bowler hat. They send me wine. The house is far too grand. I've bought a new umbrella stand. Today I visited the church beside the shrine. I'm learning English from a book. Most exciting. It's called A Bowler Hat.
I wear a bowler hat. They send me wine. The house is far too grand. I bought a new umbrella stand. Today I visited the church beside the shrine. I'm learning English from a book. Most exciting. It's called a bowler hat.
Again, you know, it's him being obsequious to Lord Abe, humbly asking his indulgence. And meanwhile, he's getting his kickbacks from whoever he's getting these nice houses for. And he's probably, I mean, I assume he's probably taking a cut himself, or he's obviously making somebody very happy, and they're sending him gifts. And it's interesting, you know, he talks about his house being far too grand, and we'll see in a couple of verses if it's still too grand or if he is constantly wanting more. In the Western fashion. And then, you know, the church beside the shrine is sort of a sad, you know, indication of the Westernization and the role of missionaries to change the cultural habits of people around the world. Whether people agree with the role of missionaries or not, you know, there obviously there's a church beside a shrine. A shrine is super simple, and a church is a pretty big building and can be pretty grand. And then, you know, going back to the bowler hat, going back to the umbrella stand, like, you know, these are super Western things. You know, in Asia, there are sort of parasols. You know, you would have like silk screened parasols to protect against the sun. But I think of a bowler hat, and I think of an umbrella, and I do think of George Banks in Mary Poppins. It's very, very British.
Yeah, that's the thing here, is that what I find the most fascinating about this song, he is stating these things, these truths, while he sings, that I find to be at least tinged with sadness, but I don't think that he himself is necessarily like upset by it. He seems to be, as the song progresses, more and more allured to the Western ways of doing things. He likes all the trinkets that he's getting. He enjoys, I think, some of this, the power that he actually has. But then he has those devastating things, like the church beside the shrine. Like, that is an image that he is very quick to put out there. Learning English from a book, you know, I think that there's these elements here that point to the fact that, like, he's embracing this Western style of stuff coming in without really fully internalizing the fact that he's losing part of himself at the same time, if that makes sense.
Right.
Anyways, I think there's a lot of subtext that goes on here.
For sure. Yeah, and even the language, you know, he says he's learning English from a book. And then what he follows up with is an incredibly British statement, which is using most as a modifier.
Right.
It's, oh, that is most exciting. You know, that's not something you wouldn't hear a Japanese person saying, oh yeah, that's most exciting. That's a very British term. So it's, you know, he's just getting more and more westernized and drawn into this way of life. And it's, you know, affecting the way he speaks.
Now, there is, of course, the original Broadway cast. There's the revival with B.D. Wong in it. I don't know how familiar you are with it. There is this English opera version from around like 2004, I think is when it came out. There's a recording of that too. That's the only other recording I can find of Pacific Overtures.
I don't know that one.
It unfortunately has an all-white cast, which I think is why most people don't talk about it all that much. And I'm not that fond of the recording, to be brutally honest. Regardless, in that recording, what's odd is that they actually have additional lyrics for the, or not lyrics, but additional things for the reciter to say, which is not in the original script. I looked that up. It's definitely not in the Finishing the Half book that Sondheim wrote. So I don't know who decided to add in those additional lyrics. Because in this section I just read about like these residences that they're not really happy with, he was on this kind of long aside about like the German specifically are not very fond of it and everything like that. Anyways, I don't know why there's this whole like additional part that's added into it. I just find it weird and odd.
Maybe deny a little culpability in their own westernization of other countries.
Feels like to me.
We were never an empire. We never imposed our culture on other people like the Japanese or the Indians or anybody in Africa and Asia and everywhere else.
Like that's what it feels like to me. It's like so a bit of apologist. It's like, oh, like we as like the original, well, not the original, but one of the grand empire builders, we have to be like, oh, but like Germany was worse.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's what they have to do. So the reciter continues on. He says, of all the Westerners with whom I have to deal, the merchants are the most worrisome. They import goods we do not need and export those we cannot do without. Last month, they bought and shipped to Shanghai so much flour that the price here almost tripled. The noodle makers were affected most severely and threatened to set fire to the Western warehouses. I found it necessary to restrain them. And then Kiyama continues on. It's called a pocket watch. I have a wife. No eagle flies against the sky as eagerly as I have flown against my life. One smokes American cigars. The Dutch ambassador was most rude. I will remember that.
It's called a pocket watch. I have a wife. No eagle flies against the sky as eagerly as I have flown against my life. One smokes American cigars. The Dutch ambassador was most rude. I will remember that.
What does this pocket watch represent?
Oh, that's wealth for sure. I mean, that's you know, at this time, the pocket watch, it's the only portable timekeeping device around at that time, right? And this is before the wristwatch. The wristwatch came about in World War I in the trenches because you wouldn't lose your pocket watch. But the pocket watch, you know, the people that would have those, you know, they're intricate little pieces of machinery that are pretty incredible the way those things work.
Oh,
Before batteries, before, you know, it's the mainspring and all of these intricate, you know, little devices. That's not something that a samurai would have. And but what's really interesting to me is this, especially when it comes to his former identity of being a samurai, is this needing to restrain the noodle makers. You know, he talks about the merchants are doing these things, but instead of legislating what the merchants are allowed to do, I'm actually going to jail the noodle makers. I'm going to jail the Japanese, not the Dutch, not the Germans, not the English. And that's so antithetical to what the samurai is all about. You know, he's supposed to protect Japan. And he's doing the opposite.
Yeah, especially I think this has that added weight by the fact that he was a low level one, to be truthful, but still a samurai himself. That's what he started off as being. What I also like the fact, and I'm I feel like this was done on purpose, but I sometimes read too much into lyrics, I will admit. But the fact that he smokes American cigars and uses the eagle as the bird that he's talking about, I don't think is a mistake either.
Right. It's not a sparrow.
Exactly. This is like that eagle, the symbol of America specifically, and is also now smoking these imported American cigars, the high life he's on here currently. So, yeah, he's talking all about the fact of all this privilege that he is starting to get in his own life.
Mm. And also, I mean, cigars, it's not the most healthy thing. This is also me reading into it as well. But I think there's a sort of toxicity that comes from like, oh, yeah, I'm going to breathe in America and it's going to pollute my system.
And I think we do need to point out about those like three things that are mentioned in the very first stanza. He now has a wife.
Right.
We don't get to know much about her, of course, but like he now has a wife. He is talking about the eagle, the second bird that he's brought up. And again, is talking about this Dutch ambassador who is rude to him. But he's going to remember this rudeness as he continues on, which I think is interesting because like the next thing that the reciter is going to talk about is the fact that the Westerners don't understand like the samurai code and like the traditions of Westerners are not actually being rude. They actually, that's just how they are sort of thing. And yet he is doing the same exact thing with this Dutch ambassador potentially. So I think there's a lot of that wrapped up into this too.
Yeah. And I think it also indicates, you know, before he says the Dutch ambassador is no fool, I must remember that, you know, it's a callback to that, but it's also the passage of time. It indicates the power that he's gained. That it's, you know, oh, I'll need to remember this. Like, I'm taking notes of people. And he's I don't want to say conniving. He's crafty. He's crafty. And he recognizes, I need to pay attention to this guy. And then later on, it's not, I must remember that. It's, I will remember that. Because now he has the power to take action and to get vengeance if he needs to.
Yeah, absolutely. So the reciter next says, although the Westerners have been in residence for upwards of 6 years now, our samurai still mistake their foreign manners for disrespect. To avoid unpleasant incidents, I have required all samurai to remove their swords before entering the city. And then Kiyama sings, I wind my pocket watch. We serve white wine. The house is far too small. I killed a spider on the wall. One of the servants thought it was a lucky sign. I read Spinoza every day. Formidable. Where is my bowler hat?
I wind my pocket watch. We serve white wine. The house is far too small. I killed a spider on the wall. One of the servants thought it was a lucky sign. I read Spinoza every day. Formidable. Where is my bowler hat?
So, Sam, I have to confess, this is going to be the section where I need the most help to understand what's going on, I think. specifically the end part. But let's talk about that, because we keyed this up a little bit, about how this references back to chrysanthemum tea, right?
Right.
So, back in chrysanthemum tea, the soothsayer says, spider on the wall signifies success, which is supposed to signify, oh, this is superstition, like, the Westerners are not going to believe this sort of thing. And he now is the exact same. It's like, that's what the servants think. Like, they're still prescribed to this superstition, but I am above that now.
Right.
I think that's interesting that we've gotten that callback to the other song.
Right. It's sort of the irony of what is barbarism.
Mm.
Is it barbaric to believe that a spider on the wall is a lucky sign, or is it barbaric to kill the lucky sign where it stands?
Right.
In front of the people who believe in it. And again, it just shows him his rise to power and him losing his sense of self and culture and tradition, religion. It's a sad song. It's a sad song in terms of cultural indoctrination. And I mean, I like it a lot. I don't listen to it and like cry or anything, but it's I think it's an interesting and sad song about, you know, the Westernization of countries, you know?
Right. And you know, this is the hard part about this show in general for me. And I've talked about this with a couple of other guests as well. You know, specifically when we get to that last song of the show next, sometimes I have a hard time really grappling with, like, what does the show want me to feel? Like, I think that, especially in this song, I think we're supposed to empathize with the fact, oh, like, he's losing his culture. He's losing himself to this, you know, different way of life. And I think you have to combat that with the fact that you do have to somewhat evolve with the times. And I don't know how you do that. Like, I don't know how necessarily you evolve into like a modern society, we'll say, without losing a part of your culture at the same time.
Right.
But I'm sure there's a way to do it without sacrificing your entire culture as
right.
well.
Right.
Right.
And I would argue, you know, you look at Japan today, and I would argue that they didn't sacrifice their entire culture. You know, it's mm-hmm. they still are culturally Japanese, and you get outside of the major cities and you'll still see fishing villages. You'll still see, mm-hmm. you know, Japanese tradition. So it's not like the West went through and just raised the entire country and then rebuilt it with brick and mortar and made it, you know, a Western nation. But this song also is sort of a reminder that in the end, we're all human. And mm-hmm. whether you're Western or Eastern, or whether you're American or Dutch or Japanese, as soon as you start to gain power, you forget about where you came from. And that's Kayama's journey right. in this whole song. And he's, you know, he's remarried. He's forgot. I have a wife. It's not, oh, I have a new wife. I have a wife now. It's great. I forget all yeah. about my old wife.
You're right.
Who killed herself. You know, like, and even requiring all samurai to remove their swords before entering the city is just such a betrayal of his former self.
Oh, yeah, completely. Now, here is the part where I'm going to need a little bit of help, I hope, I think.
I hope you're not going to ask me to tell you who Spinoza was, because I actually know.
Yeah, tell me about the history of Spinoza. So I know very tangentially Spinoza in that I knew he was a philosopher. That was basically my base knowledge, and nothing much more than that. So I will be the first to admit, this is basically a very cursory bit of research that I did here. Spinoza is Dutch, actually. So an interesting relevance of this song, because he keeps talking about the Dutch ambassador. Very quickly, influential philosopher and writer. He's well known for his like biblical criticism. And then our modern thoughts around like the self and like the universe were essentially initiated by him. His most famous work was something called Ethics, published a year after his death, but it rebuked another philosopher, Descartes' conception of mind and body dualism. I'm speaking like I know what any of this means, but it's
sounds good to
it's
me.
Basic, yeah. Basically, he was like one of the first people that like, you know what? Like our concept of like we are like singular beings and we have self-determinism and all that kind of stuff kind of started with Spinoza.
Hmm. Which makes a lot of sense in this song.
Exactly. And he had died 200 years before the events that are happening in this song are happening, because he died in the 1600s. Ooh. So he's talking about like an older philosopher, but he's reading all his books. So he's bringing that up. And I think absolutely is resonant with this song, as Kiyama is like moving from this idea of like Japanese spiritualism into like this more like Western idea of the self. Okay.
And it's also, you know, if he's a Dutch philosopher, then it's also calling back to that Dutch ambassador, and just he's
yeah
know your enemy, which is a Western
100%.
I mean, and that's an Eastern philosophy in itself, is know your enemy. That's Sun Tzu, which is not Japanese. That's Chinese, but
right.
But still Eastern.
The part that I get hung up on is the next line where he says "formidable," like he's doing that in French, and translates into English as formidable. But I was trying to figure out, like, so does that reference Spinoza somehow? And I couldn't find anything like that he wrote something like that or that referred to him at all. The only thing that I think Sondheim might be playing around with here is that in French, formidable, not slang, it's a colloquialism that means excellent. So how he said most excellent a few stanzas ago, he is now basically saying the same thing, but in French. So showing that he's more cultured and knows like multiple languages, I think is what is going on here. But that's me kind of making something up.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You got me there. Yeah. You know, this is one where I didn't dive too deep into Spinoza or Formidable, but I'll take your word for it for sure.
Great. I am so smart.
Yes.
So the reciter continues on and he says, "I will not bother you with details of the rowdy sailors and adventurers who plague our ports. As you know, provisions of the treaties which you signed 8 years ago make it impossible for us to deal with them. But fortunately, the behavior of the foreign consuls and ambassadors themselves have been above reproach. They have built themselves a club complete with bar and billiards room, and only gentlemen may enter." And then Kiyama sings, "It's called a monocle. I've left my wife. No bird exploring in the sky explores as well as I the corners of my life. One must keep moving with the times. The Dutch ambassador is a fool. He wears a bowler hat.
It's called a monocle. I've left my wife. No bird exploring in the sky explores as well as I the corners of my life. One must keep moving with the times. The Dutch ambassador is a fool. He wears a bowler hat.
And I think that might be the best self-own that I've ever heard in in musical theater, which is, like, he has been talking this whole song or singing this whole song about him wearing a bowler hat himself, and he's kind of almost conflating that. It's like that the Dutch ambassador's a fool and he also wears a bowler hat. I think that is such an interesting, like, juxtaposition that he's putting there.
Right. Well, and it's also, I think it's that he's moving with the times, and maybe the Dutch ambassador is a little behind. He's not caught up. He hasn't caught up to Kayama because Kayama has surpassed him now. And he still wears a bowler hat. I can't believe you're still wearing JNCO jeans, man. Like, it's 2021. What are you doing?
For my cold, dead hands, you'll take my JNCO jeans. Anything about the monocle specifically that you think? Is that, again, is something to do with, like wealth and stuff that people had?
Yeah, I imagine so. I think it's also I think it's something that a gentleman would wear. I think it's something that Mr. Monopoly wears and Mr. Peanut and all, right. You know. And so he's talking about, oh, you know, these foreign consuls and ambassadors, they made a club and nobody can get in except for gentlemen. So I'm going to be a gentleman. I'm going to drop the bowler hat. I'm going to pick up a monocle. I'm going to go to this gentleman's club. I'm going to cheat on my wife and then leave her.
The way the gentlemen do. Yeah.
Right. The way the gentlemen do. It's very gentlemanly. Sure.
Well, I think the fact that he's like the ambassadors are so, like, above reproach, and yet he's calling the Dutch ambassador like a complete fool. Like, he kind of sees through the facade a little bit.
And maybe he doesn't even know what's going on. He just hears sailors and adventurers. I won't bother you with details. I don't know the details. I don't spend time with the sailors anymore. Maybe that's it. You know, it's like, oh, those guys are beneath me. I deal with the ambassadors and I know what they're doing because they're more important.
Like, this is where I'm not convinced either way, because I think you can read it in a couple of different ways here. But, you know, he starts off the song by saying, like, the Dutch ambassador is no fool. I must remember that. And now he's come to this point, I'm like, no, he is a fool and nothing. Like, he just says, and he wears a bowler hat. So he doesn't even talk about, like, trying to remember or anything like that. So he's almost lost that ability to be like, oh, like, I need to observe and, like, understand what's going on here.
Right. No, yeah.
And so who is the real fool then in that case, if he is going to be continue working with this person and forgetting the times that have happened in the past? Like, I don't know. I think he might be calling himself a fool at this point.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Because he does. Yeah, I will remember that when he doesn't.
Yeah. And I just think the other thing that I was going to call out here is, like, one must keep moving with the times. Right. And that's his whole thing. He says, like, no, I have to keep adding more, doing more. I have to continue to be conceived of as a gentleman here, even with this club that I'm convinced is not even subtly racist about keeping people out of their club, probably.
Right. Oh, I bet. Yep. And so in order to get in, you have to shun all of your old ways and be as right. Western as possible. It's very Frank Shepherd, I think, is one must keep moving yeah. with the times. You know, it's burn your bridges, start again.
That's right.
That sort of mentality of what blind ambition does to a person. And even, you know, he talks about the going back to the rowdy sailors and adventurers, like he's somebody who there's a former sailor on the other side of the stage and it's his former best friend, Manjuro.
Right.
And Manjuro was a sailor. And now he's just, you know, the person that he would have spent all his time with while he's reciting poems, going back to introduce him to his home and his wife, is now just a rowdy, like those people are rowdy. They're riffraff. That's something I think is kind of interesting about that as well.
You really see as this song progresses on how he is turning on his own countrymen, his own culture, in the name of, like, well, it's progress, but losing kind of his humanity at the same time.
Right.
So it finishes off here with the reciter saying, "My lord, here in Uraga, we have reached an understanding with the Westerners. Of course, I wish them gone, but while they remain, I shall try to turn their presence into an advantage rather than a burden. Last week, I joined them in a fox hunt." And then Kiyama sings, "They call them spectacles. I drink much wine. I take imported pills. I have a house up in the hills. I've hired British architects to redesign. One must accommodate the times as one lives them. One must remember that. And then he finishes off, it's called a cutaway.
They call them spectacles. I drink much wine. I take imported pills. I have a house up in the hills. I've hired British architects to redesign. One must accommodate the times as one lives them. One must remember that. It's called a cutaway.
As he puts on a different suit.
Your humble servant, he finished, the reciter is, your humble servant, Kayama Yatsama.
Right.
Because he almost forgot. He almost forgot to be obsequious there for a second.
That's right.
He gave away too much. He said the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet or something.
That's right. How do you feel about how this song ends?
Oh, it's an interesting one. I mean, the reciter, the letter is, of course I wish them gone, but while they remain, I shall try to turn their presence into an advantage rather than a burden. It's mm-hmm. I don't want them here, but they're going to take me on a fox hunt, so I'm going to go, and that'll be cool, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm one of the gentlemen now, so I'm riding on a horse and shooting at small animals while dogs hunt them down. You know, I think a fox hunt is like the apex of privilege. Just terrifying a poor thing, and it's not even like an ordinary hunt where you're like sitting in a tree stand waiting for deer to come by so you can get food for your family. It's like it's a very brutal, terrifying, cruel act, I think. And that's for him to do that coming from the sort of a Shintoist or a Shinto mm-hmm. way of thinking of everything has a spirit, everything has its existence, even inanimate objects have a spirit in the Shinto religion, to terrify a creature before killing it mercilessly for fun, I think is a pretty brutal thing for somebody to do. It's a pretty brutal transition to make.
Well, yeah. And again, I am not the most knowledgeable about like Japanese folklore and stuff like that. I do know like foxes show up a lot in like Japanese myths and stuff like that. Mm. Usually showing, how do I put it? They're kind of like owls in Western mythology, where they're usually like very smart and like give knowledge and stuff like that too.
Right. Anyways, I honestly don't know that much
about
either.
Some superstitions with them.
Right. I do know I've played what's a samurai game? Ghost of Tsushima. If you're a video game,
yeah.
Right. And there are foxes play a big part in that, but that's, you know, a contemporary PS4 game and not a not actually, you know, Japanese tradition. It seems pretty accurate for a video game.
As accurate as it can be, right? the thing that I actually really love about this ending, other than the fact that, you know, we're ending off this song, somber notes, like, have to accommodate the times, like, such a Western thing, and he's taking all these pills and stuff like that to, you know, mm-hmm. be seen as upper class. But it's that very last line, it's called a cutaway, which I find fascinating that is how this song ends, only because I was doing some research on this. This is not an original thought. I am stealing this whole cloth from another person I was reading that had a write-up on it. There is three ways that you can actually read that line, and I'm convinced it's probably meant to be all three.
Oh, yeah, knowing Sondheim, sure.
Yeah. So the first, of course, is that the suit that he's putting on is legitimately called a cutaway. That is what they called the suit that he's putting on.
Right.
The second is that a cutaway is also referring to an illustration that usually shows you like inside something. So like in biology terms, if you think about like the anatomy of a cell and they have it like cut open and they show you like the different parts about that. But like Kiyama is doing that to himself in this song. You're basically seeing like every time he interjects is like a cutaway into like his thought process.
Ooh, I hadn't thought about that one. I hadn't thought about that form of cutaway, but I know the other two. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the third one is, he sings this, cuts away to the next scene. So in a cinematic way, this is like doing a cutaway into the next thing. So I think that there might be at the very least two meanings to this, and three possibly,
right,
that this is referring to.
Yeah, very likely. It's just super clever. Just a good just a well-written song. Yeah, and also I think, you know, going back to the to his verse here, he drinks much wine. It's not they give him wine. He has a ton of wine. He's going to drink it and get drunk.
Yeah. Drinking wine, popping pills, man.
Yeah, you know.
Living the life.
That's the Western way, isn't it? You know, go to Ibiza. Yeah. He's hired British architects to redesign his house up in the hills. He has so much power now that he's not asking the British for favors. He's hiring them to redesign his house. So he has a lot of money. He has a lot of power, and he's using it to get what he wants. And what he wants is always more, which is as Manjiro walks out dressed as a samurai. You see the complete contrast in who Kayama was and who he's become.
And I think that's the super fascinating thing at what this leads into is like Manjiro has seen the West and has come back to Japan and has kind of been like, no, I want to like be more Japanese than I was before. Whereas Kiyama is like, has seen like the warships and everything coming into his culture and be like, no, I'm going to actually do more of that. So like their splintering of their friendship and also the splintering of like how they want to live their lives is like very apparent from like this song and then into the next scene.
Right. And I wonder what that is. Maybe it's Manjiro. He went to Boston and he saw this big developed Western city and went back and was so excited because it's so cool and he wants to tell people about it. But then as he sees the country changing into becoming another Boston, and he's like, I don't want this. You know, that's what I imagine it is Manjiro has seen it and Kayama hasn't. So Kayama doesn't have the context to say like, I need to be wary of what this is becoming. He's the frog that's sitting in the pot of slowly boiling water.
Boiling water.
And Manjiro is the one that jumps in and jumps out.
I will say too, that is usually what people think when they do visit Boston, which is like, I don't want this to happen to my city.
So. I went to school there, you know.
I say Boston. That affectionately. I actually liked Boston when I visited it. I should be very clear. So I guess in general then, Sam, when we take a look at this, like, what are your feelings about this song as it relates to like Pacific Overtures as a whole?
Well, I do think, you know, like we said, I think it's overall the thesis of the show. I think it's about power. I think it's about the gaining of power and what that does to somebody and what it makes them forget about themselves and who they are and where they came from. And that's on the individual level, and on the grander scheme of things, you know, it's how cultures change and how cultures influence each other. And some do it more violently than others. And some things like the bowler hat it's a soft power thing. You know, you get your blue jeans, get blue jeans into Africa, and all of a sudden it's an American continent, you know?
Right.
It's all those different kinds of power. We've already seen them come in with their gunships, but now it's the bowler hats. Now it's the spectacles and the white wine. I think it's a brilliant song. I think Pacific Overtures is a brilliant piece.
Yeah.
That is obviously one of the weirder ones of the Sondheim shows. It's a little more inaccessible than others, but I'm a fan.
We'll talk about that just to finish off this podcast here. To that point, do you have a theory as to why this might be one of those shows that is the least produced, the least revived of his shows?
I do think that sometimes people are hesitant to pick shows that require them to have a cast that's fully people of color. That's not to criticize the industry as a whole. It's, you know, to say some regional houses may be hesitant to do that if they're in a city that doesn't have a large Asian population, large Asian actor population. They don't have the money to import actors from New York or LA. You know, that might be a reason in the regional scene, at least. And I think it's partially due to its inaccessibility, or relative inaccessibility, that it is so foreign for being an American musical, but written by Americans. And white Americans, and you know, but at the same time, it's purposefully written in a way to make it feel foreign to Americans. And so I think maybe people reading it or people watching it might say, oh, yeah, not for our theater, not for this year. But it's also a very difficult piece. Sondheim is difficult in general. And so I think some people don't have the patience to put in the effort to find a cast of 15 Asian Americans that can tackle Sondheim, which is a real shame because there are plenty of us out there that are more than capable. But I do think that that's a factor. I think that's a factor.
I will say, to his credit for this show in particular, Sondheim has been very vocal about, like, it has to be Asians who are in these roles. It does not work if you have white people in these roles.
Right.
And what he said about that London opera version, because he actually went inside and it's like, no, has to be Asian people that are in these roles.
I think if you have an all white cast, it is a tragic irony that like how westernized do you really want this to be? What statement are you trying to make here? Are you trying to make like, oh, we've completely replaced the Japanese now? Is that, you know, ultimately, I think that's what you get when you do that. I have been in the industry for over 10 years now. My first production of The King and I that I did, we had a mostly white cast. The King was white, very talented actor, really nice guy. It's not his fault he was cast in the role. You know, I don't blame him. That doesn't fly anymore. And it shouldn't fly because in King and I, Act Two opens with Western people funny, which is this criticism of Westerners thinking, oh, we're so barbaric because we dress differently and we talk differently. And now here we are, the king's wives, who are normally in these beautiful silk wraps. And now we're just in these ridiculous hoop skirts that make absolutely no sense. Like, they're so, how is a sensible silk skirt, how is that barbaric? And then putting these hoops around yourself to protect yourself from, to keep men outside of your circle. How is that not barbaric?
Right.
And so when you do a show like that, when you have a show that's made for people of color, and then you cast white people in those roles, we opened that that Act Two with a bunch of white women in hoop skirts. And that is not a juxtaposition of any sort. It doesn't make you cringe to look at white women in hoop skirts. You're like, oh, it's England, you know?
Yeah, right.
I look at this show and I look at the time that it came out, Pacific Overtures I'm talking about now, and that they went to great lengths to cast an all-Asian cast, an Asian-American. I respect that, and I'm very grateful that they did that. I think it paved the way for other people to do it in the future. Still, some people somewhere are still not doing it. It's ridiculous to me that they can get away with it, and they often don't anymore. You know, John Wideman, I think you can credit a lot of this to John Wideman. I know we're talking about songs, and that's more to do with Sondheim. I think, you know, John Wideman, I believe he went to Harvard. I think he went to Harvard and got his degree in Asian history or East Asian culture, something.
Something like that.
So he, honestly, I think John Wideman knows more about Asian history and culture than I do. You know, I'm not going to, just because I'm Asian American doesn't mean I know all there is about East Asian culture and history, you know, but John Wideman studied it. And so I think we can credit him with a lot of this, with the historical accuracies and with the attempts to get that Asian cast in there. I think you can credit Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim with that as well. One criticism I do have is that I think we're starting to see changes now in the industry in terms of, you know, the creative teams and the production teams and trying to get people of color in there. Because while this show had an all Asian cast, the cast doesn't see any residuals for this. When the production is done again, you know, those royalties, they go to Stephen Sondheim, they go to John Wideman, they go to Hal Prince.
Right.
If they had, you know, Susie Kikuchi in there as a choreographer, is you know, if they, and Pat Birch was fantastic as a choreographer for this. She did her homework and she did some really cool stuff. But if they had a Japanese American on that creative team that would be getting royalties, you know, if they had a consultant that was helping John Wideman with the historical accuracies, that would helping Sondheim with the historical accuracies, I think that's something that we could still be celebrating today. And I think that would have paved the way for that to happen. Not just the non-traditional cast, or not just the race and culturally specific casting, but also the providing of opportunities in leadership and financial gain outside of the run of the show, the bubble of the show, on into the future, on into the long running estate of the show. And I think that was a missed opportunity. And I wish that they had done that, but you know, things are starting to happen now. And we can credit some of the change that's happened in the industry, at least for Asian Americans, to Pacific Overtures.
Well, thank you so much for your insight here, Sam. This has been really fun. If people wanted to stay in contact with you or see what you're up to, what's the easiest way to do so online?
You know, I have deleted Facebook from my phone. I think I've started to kind of separate myself from the evils of Facebook. That said, I still have an Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. So I haven't separated myself, entirely. But if you want to check me out online, I would say Soapbox Sam is my handle, at Soapbox Sam, SOAPBOX Sam, SAM. I'm also on Twitter, but I don't really use that much. I'm probably going to delete it at some point soon. It's just when I get angry at Ted Cruz, I'll put something
so
up.
You must be on there a lot, then. You must be there a lot. All right, perfect. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you so much, Kyle. It's been a blast.
Thank you so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network, to Rumi, and to the Calgary Foundation this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. Next week, we'll be talking about Pretty Lady, the prettiest creepy song ever written. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.